The Novels of Charles Dickens. An Introduction by David Timpson. David Copperfield. David Copperfield was begun by Dickens in 1849, but at first it proved hard going for him. "Though I know what I want to do, I am lumbering on like a stage wagon," Dickens wrote to his friend Forster. Finding the right name for his main character, always an important first step for Dickens, was proving difficult. Originally, the novel was to be entitled Mag's Diversions, which became, among other experiments, Magbury, Flowerberry, Topflower, Copperstone, and finally, Copperfield. Part of the problem, too, was that Dickens was trying something new. His friend Forster had suggested that he wrote his next novel in the first person, just by way of change. The exercise inevitably led him to identify himself with the narrator, and in so doing he was reluctantly forced to visit his own past, which was nothing short of traumatic for him. Dickens was startled when Forster pointed out to him that David Copperfield's initials were a reverse of his own, and he declared it was in keeping with the fates and chances that were always befalling him. Like David Copperfield, Dickens had been forced to work in a blacking factory at the age of 12. The sense of humiliation he had felt in this demeaning job would never leave him, and the spectre of failure and its resulting poverty fueled his fanatical desire to succeed at all costs. Although not an orphan like David becomes, Dickens felt his parents had betrayed him by neglecting his schooling in favour of him earning a few shillings at the blacking factory to increase the family income. And even when an opportunity arose for him to be released from the drudgery, he would bitterly remember to his dying day that his mother was warm for me to be sent back. As he developed his narrative, Dickens uncovered dark areas of his own personality. He writes about the failure of mothers and fathers in this novel. All the female characters seem to be a variation on the theme of good and bad mothers, just as the male characters represent similar aspects of the father figure. David's mother is weak and ineffectual. So is Dora, his wife, who is too childish to be a mother herself. David has a succession of surrogate mothers, Peggotty, his nurse, his no-nonsense aunt, Betsy Trotwood, who Forster described as a gnarled and knotted piece of female timber, and ultimately, one could argue, the steady, reliable, always supportive Agnes. When it comes to fathers, Dickens revenges himself on his own feckless father by creating one of his most brilliant comic creations, Mr. Micawber. Dickens may have intended a more critical portrait of his father, but his comic instinct overruled everything. The rambling, verbose, pseudo-literary style of Mr. Micawber's utterances exactly reflected John Dickens's flamboyant way of expressing himself, and Micawber develops into a man to sympathise with rather than criticise. In fact, as he wrote, Dickens seems to have fallen in love with Micawber, and therefore also with his father. "The longer I live, the better man I think him," he exclaimed afterwards. So, writing about his father fictitiously had led to an expiation. Dickens may have felt that his father had let him down as a child, but John Dickens was not a cruel man, only weak. It is the fictional Mr. Murdstone who represents the cruel father figure, not Micawber. It is Murdstone who beats David and sends him to the factory. Dickens's painful journey back into his own life resulted in a masterpiece. An ingenious blend of fact with fiction, a mingling of youthful innocence and mature reflection on that youth, as in the portrayal of David's blind hero worship of the cad Steerforth, even while Steerforth is secretly seducing little Emily. Dickens creates, too, a gallery of wonderfully vivid characters, whose images and language have passed into common usage. Micawber, bald-headed and egg-shaped, always waiting for something to turn up. Uriah Heep, whose red hair hints at his devilish scheming, hides behind being so very humble. While Mr. Barkis, the carrier, declares he is willing to marry Clara Peggotty. It is a rites of passage novel. David faces the difficulties we all experience in growing up and coming to terms with the world around us. Dickens declares that we must learn to be generous and value family life, and because David's story is largely Dickens's own, it is the more convincing. Dickens referred to this novel as his favourite child. "I seem to be sending some part of myself into the shadowy world," he wrote. David meets the Micawbers.
"Master Copperfield," said Mrs. Micawber, "I make no stranger of you, and therefore do not hesitate to say that Mr. Micawber's difficulties are coming to a crisis." It made me very miserable to hear it, and I looked at Mrs. Micawber's red eyes with the utmost sympathy. "With the exception of the heel of a Dutch cheese, which is not adapted to the wants of a young family," said Mrs. Micawber, "there is really not a scrap of anything in the larder. I was accustomed to speak of the larder when I lived with Papa and Mamma, and I use the word almost unconsciously. What I mean to express is that there is nothing to eat in the house." "Dear me," I said in great concern. I had 2 or 3 shillings of my week's money in my pocket, from which I presumed that it must have been on a Wednesday night when we held this conversation, and I hastily produced them, and with heartfelt emotion begged Mrs. Micawber to accept of them as a loan. But that lady, kissing me and making me put them back in my pocket, replied that she couldn't think of it. "No, my dear Master Copperfield," said she, "far be it from my thoughts. But you have a discretion beyond your years, and can render me another kind of service if you will, and a service I will thankfully accept of." I begged Mrs. Micawber to name it. "I have parted with the plate myself," said Mrs. Micawber. 6 tea, 2 salt, and a pair of sugars I have at different times borrowed money on, in secret, with my own hands. But the twins are a great tie, and to me, with my recollections of Papa and Mamma, these transactions are very painful. There are still a few trifles that we could part with. Mr. Micawber's feelings would never allow him to dispose of them, and Clickett," this was the girl from the workhouse, "being of a vulgar mind, would take painful liberties if so much confidence was reposed in her. Master Copperfield, if I might ask you—" I understood Mrs. Micawber now, and begged her to make use of me to any extent. I began to dispose of the more portable articles of property that very evening, and went out on a similar expedition almost every morning, before I went to Murdstone and Grinby's. Mr. Micawber had a few books on a little chiffonier, which he called the library, and those went first. I carried them, one after another, to a bookstall in the City Road, one part of which near our house was almost all bookstalls and bird shops then, and sold them for whatever they would bring. The keeper of this bookstall, who lived in a little house behind it, used to get tipsy every night, and to be violently scolded by his wife every morning. More than once, when I went there early, I had audience of him in a turn-up bedstead with a cut in his forehead or a black eye, bearing witness to his excesses overnight. I'm afraid he was quarrelsome in his drink. And he, with a shaking hand, endeavouring to find the needful shillings in one or other of the pockets of his clothes, which lay upon the floor, while his wife, with a baby in her arms and her shoes down at heel, never left off rating him. Sometimes he had lost his money, and then he would ask me to call again. But his wife had always got some, had taken his, I dare say, while he was drunk, and secretly completed the bargain on the stairs as we went down together. At the pawnbroker's shop, too, I began to be very well known. The principal gentleman who officiated behind the counter took a good deal of notice of me, and often got me, I recollect, to decline a Latin noun or adjective, or to conjugate a Latin verb in his ear while he transacted my business. After all these occasions, Mrs. Micawber made a little treat, which was generally a supper, and there was a peculiar relish in these meals which I well remember. At last Mr. Micawber's difficulties came to a crisis, and he was arrested early one morning and carried over to the King's Bench Prison in the borough. He told me as he went out of the house that the God of Day had now gone down upon him, and I really thought his heart was broken, and mine too. But I heard afterwards that he was seen to play a lively game at skittles before noon. On the first Sunday after he was taken there, I was to go and see him and have dinner with him. I was to ask my way to such a place, and just short of that place, I should see such another place, and just short of that I should see a yard which I was to cross, and keep straight on until I saw a turnkey. All this I did, and when at last I did see a turnkey, poor little fellow that I was, and thought how, when Roderick Random was in a debtor's prison, there was a man there with nothing on him but an old rug, the turnkey swam before my dimmed eyes and my beating heart. Mr. Micawber was waiting for me within the gate, and we went up to his room, top story but one, and cried very much. He solemnly conjured me, I remember, to take warning by his fate, and to observe that if a man had £20 a year for his income, and spent £19.19/6, he would be happy, but that if he spent £20 1, he would be miserable. After which he borrowed a shilling of me for porter, gave me a written order on Mrs. Micawber for the amount, and put away his pocket-handkerchief, and cheered up. We sat before a little fire, with two bricks put within the rusted grate, one on each side to prevent its burning too many coals, until another debtor, who shared the room with Mr. Micawber, came in from the bake-house with the loin of mutton which was our joint stock repast. Then I was sent up to Captain Hopkins in the room overhead, with Mr. Micawber's compliments, and I was his young friend, and would Captain Hopkins lend me a knife and fork.
David meets Betsy Trotwood.
The unbroken stillness of the parlour window leading me to infer after a while that she was not there, I lifted up my eyes to the window above it, where I saw a florid, pleasant-looking gentleman with a grey head, who shut up one eye in a grotesque manner, nodded his head at me several times, shook it at me as often, laughed, and went away. I had been discomposed enough before, but I was so much the more discomposed by this unexpected behaviour that I was on the point of slinking off to think how I had best proceed, when there came out of the house a lady with her handkerchief tied over her cap and a pair of gardening gloves on her hands, wearing a gardening pocket like a tollman's apron, and carrying a great knife. I knew her immediately to be Miss Betsy, for she came stalking out of the house exactly as my poor mother had so often described her stalking up our garden at Blunderstone Rookery. "Go away!" said Miss Betsy, shaking her head and making a distant chop in the air with her knife. "Go along! No boys here!" I watched her, with my heart at my lips, as she marched to a corner of her garden and stooped to dig up some little root there. Then, without a scrap of courage, but with a great deal of desperation, I went softly in and stood beside her, touching her with my finger. "If you please, ma'am," I began. She started and looked up. "If you please, aunt?" "Eh?" exclaimed Miss Betsy, in a tone of amazement I have never heard approached. "If you please, aunt, I am your nephew." "Oh, Lord," said my aunt, and sat flat down in the garden path. "I am David Copperfield of Blunderstone in Suffolk, where you came on the night when I was born, and saw my dear mamma. I have been very unhappy since she died. I have been slighted and taught nothing, and thrown upon myself, and put to work not fit for me. It made me run away to you. I was robbed at first setting out, and have walked all the way, and have never slept in a bed since I began the journey." Here my self-support gave way all at once, and with a movement of my hands intended to show her my ragged state, and call it to witness that I had suffered something, I broke into a passion of crying, which, I suppose, had been pent up within me all the week. My aunt, with every sort of expression but wonder discharged from her countenance, sat on the gravel, staring at me, until I began to cry, when she got up in a great hurry, collared me, and took me into the parlour. Her first proceeding there was to unlock a tall press, bring out several bottles, and pour some of the contents of each into my mouth. I think they must have been taken out at random, for I am sure I tasted aniseed water, anchovy sauce, and salad dressing. When she had administered these restoratives, as I was still quite hysterical and unable to control my sobs, she put me on the sofa, with a shawl under my head, and the handkerchief from her own head under my feet, lest I should sully the cover, and then, sitting herself down behind the green fan or screen I have already mentioned, so that I could not see her face, ejaculated at intervals, "Mercy on us!" letting those exclamations off like minute guns. After a time, she rang the bell. "Janet," said my aunt when her servant came in, "go upstairs, give my compliments to Mr. Dick, and say I wish to speak to him." Janet looked a little surprised to see me lying stiffly on the sofa. I was afraid to move, lest it should be displeasing to my aunt, but went on her errand. My aunt, with her hands behind her, walked up and down the room, until the gentleman who had squinted at me from the upper window came in, laughing. "Mr. Dick," said my aunt, "don't be a fool, because nobody can be more discreet than you when you choose. We all know that, so don't be a fool, whatever you are." The gentleman was serious immediately, and looked at me, I thought, as if he would entreat me to say nothing about the window. "Mr. Dick," said my aunt, "you have heard me mention David Copperfield? Now don't pretend not to have a memory, because you and I know better."
"David Copperfield?"
said Mr. Dick, who did not appear to me to remember much about it.
"David Copperfield? Oh, yes, to be sure. David, certainly."
"Well," said my aunt, "this is his boy, his son. He would be as like his father as it's possible to be, if he was not so like his mother, too."
"His son," said Mr. Dick. "David's son, indeed."
"Yes," pursued my aunt, "and he has done a pretty piece of business. He has run away. Ah! His sister, Betsy Trotwood, never would have run away." My aunt shook her head firmly, confident in the character and behaviour of the girl who never was born.
"Oh, you think she wouldn't have run away?" said Mr. Dick.
"Bless and save the man," exclaimed my aunt sharply. "How he talks! Don't I know she wouldn't? She would have lived with her godmother, and we should have been devoted to one another. Where in the name of wonder should his sister, Betsy Trotwood, have run from, or to?"
"Nowhere," said Mr. Dick.
"Well, then," returned my aunt, softened by the reply, "how can you pretend to be wool-gathering, Dick, when you are as sharp as a surgeon's lancet? Now, here you see young David Copperfield, and the question I put to you is, what shall I do with him?"
"What shall you do with him?"
said Mr. Dick, feebly scratching his head.
"Oh, do with him?"
"Yes," said my aunt, with a grave look, and her forefinger held up. "Come, I want some very sound advice."
"Why, if I was you,"
said Mr. Dick, considering and looking vacantly at me,
"I should..."
The contemplation of me seemed to inspire him with a sudden idea, and he added briskly, "I should wash him." "Janet," said my aunt, turning round with a quiet triumph which I did not then understand, "Mr. Dick sets us all right. Heat the bath."
David and Dora.
I could not have wished for a prettier little wife at the opposite end of the table, but I certainly could have wished when we sat down for a little more room. I did not know how it was, but though there were only two of us, we were at once always cramped for room, and yet had always room enough to lose everything in. I suspect it may have been because nothing had a place of its own except Gyp's pagoda, which invariably blocked up the main thoroughfare. On the present occasion, Traddles was so hemmed in by the pagoda and the guitar case and Dora's flower painting and my writing table that I had serious doubts of the possibility of his using his knife and fork. But he protested with his own good humour, "Oceans of room, Copperfield, I assure you. Oceans!" There was another thing I could have wished, namely that Gyp had never been encouraged to walk about the tablecloth during dinner. I began to think there was something disorderly in his being there at all, even if he had not been in the habit of putting his foot in the salt or the melted butter. On this occasion he seemed to think he was introduced expressly to keep Traddles at bay, and he barked at my old friend and made short runs at his plate with such undaunted pertinacity that he may be said to have engrossed the conversation. However, As I knew how tender-hearted my dear Dora was, and how sensitive she would be to any slight upon her favourite, I hinted no objection. For similar reasons I made no allusion to the skirmishing plates upon the floor, or to the disreputable appearance of the casters, which were all at sixes and sevens and looked drunk, or to the further blockade of Traddles by wandering vegetable dishes and jugs. I could not help wondering in my own mind as I contemplated the boiled leg of mutton before me, previous to carving it, how it came to pass that our joints of meat were of such extraordinary shapes, and whether our butcher contracted for all the deformed sheep that came into the world. But I kept my reflections to myself. "My love," said I to Dora, "what have you got in that dish?" I could not imagine why Dora had been making tempting little faces at me, as if she wanted to kiss me.
"Oysters, dear," said Dora timidly.
"Was that your thought?" said I, delighted.
Yes, Dodie," said Dora.
"There never was a happier one," I exclaimed, laying down the carving knife and fork. "There is nothing Traddles likes so much."
"Yes, Dodie," said Dora, "and so I bought a beautiful little barrel of them, and the man said they were very good. But I am afraid there's something the matter with them. They don't seem right."
Here Dora shook her head, and diamonds twinkled in her eyes. "They're only opened in both shells," said I. "Take the top one off, my love."
"But it won't come off," said Dora, trying very hard and looking very much distressed.
"Do you know, Copperfield," said Traddles, cheerfully examining the dish, "I think it is in consequence, they are capital oysters, but I think it is in consequence of their never having been opened." They never had been opened, and we had no oyster knives, and couldn't have used them if we had. So we looked at the oysters and ate the mutton. At least we ate as much of it as was done, and made up with capers. If I had permitted him, I am satisfied that Traddles would have made a perfect savage of himself and eaten a plateful of raw meat to express enjoyment of the repast. But I would hear of no such immolation on the altar of friendship, and we had a course of bacon instead, there happening by good fortune to be cold bacon in the larder. My poor little wife was in such affliction when she thought I should be annoyed, and in such a state of joy when she found I was not, that the discomfiture I had subdued very soon vanished, and we passed a happy evening, Dora sitting with her arm on my chair, while Traddles and I discussed a glass of wine, and taking every opportunity of whispering in my ear that it was so good of me not to be a cruel, cross old boy. By and by she made tea for us, which it was so pretty to see her do, as if she was busying herself with a set of doll's tea things, that I was not particular about the quality of the beverage. Then Traddles and I played a game or two at cribbage, and Dora singing to the guitar the while, it seemed to me as if our courtship and marriage were a tender dream of mine, and the night when I first listened to her voice were not yet over.
The Storm at Sea.
In the difficulty of hearing anything but wind and waves, and in the crowd, and the unspeakable confusion, and my first breathless efforts to stand against the weather, I was so confused that I looked out to sea for the wreck, and saw nothing but the foaming heads of great waves. A half-dressed boatman, standing next to me, pointed with his bare arm, a tattooed arrow on it pointing in the same direction, to the left. Then, O great heaven, I saw it close in upon us. One mast was broken short off, 6 or 8 feet from the deck, and lay over the side, entangled in a maze of sail and rigging. And all that ruin, as the ship rolled and beat, which she did without a moment's pause and with a violence quite inconceivable, beat the side as if it would stave it in. Some efforts were even then being made to cut this portion of the wreck away, for as the ship, which was broadside on, turned towards us in her rolling, I plainly descried her people at work with axes, especially one active figure with long, curling hair, conspicuous among the rest. But a great cry, which was audible even above the wind and water, rose from the shore at this moment. The sea, sweeping over the rolling wreck, made a clean breach, and carried men, spars, casks, planks, bulwarks, heaps of such toys, into the boiling surge. The second mast was yet standing, with the rags of a rent sail and a wild confusion of broken cordage flapping to and fro. The ship had struck once, the same boatman hoarsely said in my ear, and then lifted in and struck again. I understood him to add that she was parting amidships, and I could readily suppose so, for the rolling and beating were too tremendous for any human work to suffer long. As he spoke, there was another great cry of pity from the beach. Four men arose with the wreck out of the deep, clinging to the rigging of the remaining mast, uppermost, the active figure with the curling hair. There was a bell on board, and as the ship rolled and dashed like a desperate creature driven mad, now showing us the whole sweep of her deck as she turned on her beam ends towards the shore, now nothing but her keel as she sprung wildly over and turned towards the sea, the bell rang, and its sound, the knell of those unhappy men, was borne towards us on the wind. Again we lost her, and again she rose. Two men were gone. The agony on the shore increased. Men groaned and clasped their hands. Women shrieked and turned away their faces. Some ran wildly up and down along the beach, crying for help where no help could be. I found myself one of these, frantically imploring a knot of sailors whom I knew not to let those two lost creatures perish before our eyes. They were making out to me in an agitated way, I don't know how, for the little I could hear I was scarcely composed enough to understand, that the lifeboat had been bravely manned an hour ago and could do nothing, and that as no man would be so desperate as to attempt to wade off with a rope and establish a communication with the shore, there was nothing left to try, when I noticed that some new sensation moved the people on the beach, and saw them part, and Ham come breaking through them to the front. I ran to him, as well as I know, to repeat my appeal for help, but distracted though I was by a sight so new to me and terrible, the determination in his face and his look out to sea, exactly the same look as I remembered in connection with the morning after Emily's flight, awoke me to a knowledge of his danger. I held him back with both arms, and implored the men with whom I had been speaking not to listen to him, not to do murder, not to let him stir from off that sand. Another cry arose on shore, and looking to the wreck, we saw the cruel sail with blow on blow beat off the lower of the two men, and fly up in triumph round the active figure left alone upon the mast. Against such a sight, and against such determination as that of the calmly desperate man who was already accustomed to lead half the people present, I might as hopefully have entreated the wind. "Master Davy," he said, cheerily grasping me by both hands, "if my time is come, 'tis come. If tad, I'll bide it. Lord above bless you, and bless all. Mates, make me ready. I'm a-going off."
These extracts have been taken from the unabridged recording of David Copperfield, read by Nicholas Bolton for Naxos Audiobooks.